I'm Elizabeth Russ, and this is the Piece of Advice podcast coming to you from the University of Oxford. Today, we're sitting down with Professor Richard Kaplan, Professor of International Relations at the University of Oxford, to talk about his latest book, Measuring Peace: Principles, Practices, and Politics. Professor Kaplan, thanks for coming.
Pleasure to be with you.
Just to begin, why are good conceptualizations of peace important for policymakers? And what does a good conceptualization of peace look like?
If you're working to build peace, you need to have a clear understanding of the peace that you're trying to build. And different conceptualizations of peace are possible, from a negative peace, the absence of armed conflict, to a positive peace, a definition of which I like from Christian Davenport, is respect and fundamental goodwill between relevant actors. But it's a positive disposition towards what might have been former combatants, former enemies. And we need to have a clear idea of the characteristics of the peace if we're going to be building peace in a conflict-affected region. But the question is, really twofold. What are the characteristics of that peace and the requirements of the peace? And the other question is who decides? Who's going to be making a determination about the quality of the peace that we're trying to build? Obviously, for this purpose, you need to take into consideration the views, the thinking of the conflict-affected population. And that's not always as easy as it's said, because, of course, we're talking about societies that are highly polarized. They've often just been through a violent conflict, and so they may not have a singular view of the kind of peace that they're trying to build. And this is where third parties can play a role constructively in trying to mediate and arrive at positions that are acceptable to all. But it is extremely important to take into consideration local perspectives.
And in the book, you identify some factors that contribute to post-conflict peace stabilization. What are these factors?
So with my colleague, Anke Heffler, we evaluated the salience of a number of factors in relation to the duration of peace. When we talk about peace stabilization, I have in mind peace duration. And we did that in all countries that have experienced peace after civil war since 1990. And we used a mixed methods approach that combines survival analysis, which is a statistical method, of 205 post-conflict peace episodes since 1990. And we supplemented that with analysis of 6 cases of post-conflict peace. Those were Burundi, East Timor, El Salvador, Liberia, Nepal, and Sierra Leone. And we found that a number of factors appear to contribute to the consolidation of peace. One robust statistical result is that victories, military victories, provide more long-lasting peace than negotiated peace settlements. Now, this shouldn't surprise us, because with military victories, often you are reducing, if not eliminating, the threat to peace from warring parties, from parties on the other side of a conflict divide. That doesn't mean to say that this should be a more attractive option, bearing in mind that what is often required to get to a military victory can be very brutal fighting that results in very severe, widespread casualties and fatalities. But if we're speaking strictly in a statistical sense, it is true that military victories provide a more long-lasting peace than negotiated peace settlements. With regard to the contribution that peacekeeping operations make to the duration of peace, we find some evidence that UN peacekeeping operations with a DDR component, disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration component, enhance the peace. We also find evidence that the presence of police forces in the mission contributes to peace duration. Finally, we find that UN peacekeeping operations have a positive effect on peace duration when the conflict ends in a peace settlement. Now, why might peacekeeping operations matter in relation to a peace settlement? One reason is that a peacekeeping operation can raise the profile of a conflict-affected country, generating greater regional and international interest in and support for peacebuilding there. But much also depends on the precise role a peacekeeping operation performs, which will vary from case to case. So UN forces can play an important role, for instance, in the verification of arms and other agreements, fostering conditions conducive to the holding of elections, and in creating a secure environment for civil society to engage, among other positive contributions. So these are all relevant factors which we identified, but in all of this, we have to keep in mind that the sample size is relatively small and that the results are sensitive to small changes as a result in the sample size. Rigorous assessments of the robustness of peace really call fundamentally for an appreciation of the characteristics of and the requirements for a stable peace in a given conflict situation, and correspondingly strong knowledge about the conflict dynamics that are specific to that conflict situation. This is a theme that comes through again and again in the book. Such an understanding, this kind of understanding that I'm referring to, which I call in a more ethnographic approach, it can't be achieved on the basis of statistical analysis of scores of peace episodes and a half dozen case studies, which is what we did. Statistical analysis is useful. It's useful in helping to identify potentially relevant factors of peace stabilization, and comparative case study analysis can also provide insights into the causal dynamics that are associated or not with these factors. But ultimately, you have to rely on a very strong knowledge about the conflict dynamics specific to that conflict situation.
Additionally, you speak about obstacles to good practice. What do these obstacles to good practice look like, and how might these obstacles be overcome by peace-building actors?
Okay, so when we're talking about good practice, we're talking about practice in measuring peace consolidation and measuring the robustness and the quality of the peace that's being established. And there are a number of potential obstacles. Some of them are more formidable than others. One is the paucity of reliable data. So most conflict-affected countries are poor countries, and prior to their wars, they would already have had weak data collection systems. After the wars, those systems have been compromised further. So there's an inherent difficulty here, which is difficult to overcome. Although satellite and other technologies are making it possible to improve on the data available. But the fact is that we are often working with rather weak data. So that's one obstacle to assessing the quality, the robustness of the peace that we're building. Another obstacle to good practice is the failure to develop indicators that can provide an accurate assessment of the quality of the peace that prevails. Indicators of progress, indicators of the quality of peace, need to be meaningful. They need to focus on concrete outcomes and impacts. So if, for instance, it's determined that the establishment and development of a professional, impartial, and independent judiciary is critical for peace consolidation, then one appropriate measure of progress would be whether there's evidence of ethnic or other bias on the part of judges in the performance of their duties, and how much trust the court system enjoys among the general public and endangered population groups in particular, and whether judges are respectful of international human rights norms. Those are all meaningful measures of this particular aspect of peace consolidation. But measuring how many judges have been trained in human rights law, by contrast, isn't a meaningful indicator of the level of competence that the judiciary has attained, although it is common practice to gravitate towards the quantifiable as a meaningful measure because it's relatively easy to analyze. It's much, much harder to determine the competence, the performance of the judiciary, the quality of their performance as they execute their responsibilities. I mean, this requires observing courts in action. It requires interviewing vulnerable groups as to how comfortable, how at ease they are with the court system. There are a number of meaningful indicators that would be required to reach a judgment that are much harder to measure than just the number of judges that might have been trained. Now, another obstacle related to the one I just mentioned is the failure to consult affected communities properly to gauge their understanding of whether and to what extent peace has been achieved and secured. I mean, it's important to comprehend what local anxieties are, what measures are required to address those anxieties, and what evidence of successful address of those anxieties would look like. So there's certainly scope for inclusion of so-called objective indicators in frameworks of analysis. I'm not saying that these should not be taken into consideration, but these need to be, if you will, road tested for local conditions to ensure that they're relevant, to ensure that they speak to the requirements for peace consolidation in the country in question. Both of these latter obstacles that I've just mentioned can be overcome with the development of contextually sensitive frameworks of analysis. That's not easy to achieve, but it is necessary.
So what is conflict analysis, and why is it crucial in the assessments of peace?
Conflict analysis is a form of analysis that allows an organization to gauge how vulnerable peace may be, how vulnerable peace may be to being compromised. It's about being sensitive to the drivers of both conflict and peace, and to giving thought to how it may be possible to inhibit the drivers of conflict and support the drivers of peace. Any peace operation should start with an adequate conflict analysis to ensure understanding of the conflict landscape. Now, what should such an analysis look like? In East Timor, Timor-Leste, where the UN deployed several peace operations from 1999, there was an outbreak of violence on the UN's watch, which caught the UN off guard. In a study he did, Olav Ofstad from the ICRC noted that the UN might have been able to anticipate the violence if it had been more aware of the conflict fault lines. And greater awareness might have been possible if the UN had performed thoroughgoing conflict analyses, which it did not. In his view, a conflict analysis would have entailed, and I'm quoting from his report, a mapping of all existing conflict and stakeholders, the threats they represented, the potential for new or changing conflicts, and the need for reconciliation and conflict resolution. To provide this, a profound understanding of the local history is required and of the connections between past and present conflicts. A thorough analysis of relations between different ethnic and other groups is a requirement, along with analysis of the relationship between political actors and different groups and actors in the informal sector, including martial groups and gangs. The analysis needs to include socioeconomic, demographic, and psychological perspectives. Relevant conflict analysis must also take into account the likely effects of the peace-building process, as well as other trends and developments in society. And I would add to Olav's list that a conflict analysis also needs to take account of any environmentally based conflict risks, such as actual or potential disputes over natural resources that could cause conflict to reemerge, natural resources that could be economically significant for conflict activities, or that could become the focal point of illegal activities, and environmental contamination that threatens livelihoods. Now, it's quite a tall order, I recognize that, but it can be done.
Excellent. And among other suggestions, you recommend that policymakers adapt an ethnographic approach to strategic assessments of peace. What exactly does that ethnographic approach look like, and how could it be implemented by peace practitioners?
So I've referred already to this, an ethnographic approach. And what I mean by that, for the purpose of strategic assessment, as I'm calling it, it would favor greater reliance on knowledge of local culture, local history, and again, as I said, the particular conflict dynamics at work in a given conflict, including at the micro level, by the way, because as we know, in a country, for instance, like the Democratic Republic of Congo, it is difficult to generalize it about conflict across the entire territory. There are, it's fair to say, multiple conflicts at work. They may have certain elements in common, but there are also distinctive features of those conflicts. And so we need to be able to speak to each of those conflicts, if you will, on their own terms. Familiarity with local context is absolutely crucial. And again, as I said, it is obviously not something that is very easy to achieve, but it is something that we need to make an effort to achieve. And if I can just invoke a little bit of history here, if we look back on U.S. misadventures in Vietnam in the 1960s and 70s, the former U.S. Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, who actually bore quite a lot of responsibility for U.S. engagement in Vietnam, one of the chief architects of that war, in his memoirs, he even acknowledged what he called our profound ignorance of the history, culture, and politics of the people in the area. And that was an ignorance that would be extremely costly in terms of lives that were lost, because for a very long time, the U.S. had a misapprehension of the nature of that conflict, seeing it primarily in East-West terms, in terms of an effort on the part of communist Russia, Soviet Union, to extend its influence and the influence of communists across the globe. Whereas what McNamara and others failed to appreciate was that this was first and foremost a struggle of national liberation, and that led by the North Vietnamese, were seeking to free themselves from first the French and the Japanese, and now the Americans. And similarly, and more recently, Rory Stewart, former British member of Parliament, in reflecting on the British engagement, and engagement of other countries in Afghanistan, identified the lack of local knowledge on the part of international personnel as what he called a central cause of the humiliating mess in Afghanistan, where Stewart himself had served in peace and state-building operations. So this has been widely recognized, what we're calling an ethnographic approach, by a number of observers, including people who have had firsthand experience with engagement in peace building. But it is, as I said, still not as widely practiced as it should be.
And lastly, what is your piece of advice?
Well, I guess what follows from what I just said really is that we need to make an effort as best we can to appreciate the conflict dynamics of the particular conflict situations in which we're engaged as third parties. And we need to work to build peace in consultation, in partnership with the affected communities. Now, we do that, we say we do that certainly, but I think it's fair to say that it's not done, to as great an extent as it could be, and that the consequences, I said, is inappropriate sometimes policies and a a failure to be sensitive to the conflict situation, which can and has in some situations resulted in a re-eruption of conflict after there has been establishment of peace.
Professor Kaplan, thank you very, very much for your time and participating in our podcast, The Piece of Advice.
Thank you.